Part 29, Chapter 6. There was a lot of activity in the bowl. Chief Chong Wan's tribe of Chinese had, for the most part, been replaced in Edinburgh by the North Chinese Johnny had sent there from Russia. The returning people were smudged and singed. Some were in a state of obvious exhaustion that not even rest on the flight from Edinburgh had eased. They rushed gladly to their children, scooping them up, embracing them, throwing questions to the older children. The dogs were straining at their leashes and barking joyously. It was a scene of glad reunion. Johnny was glad he had gotten them replaced on the rescue team. They had worked without ceasing and soon would have been unable to carry on. Yet they had worked until they nearly dropped. Watching fathers in happy chattering exchange with their youngsters, watching mothers anxiously verifying whether this or that had been done properly as to feeding and naps, Johnny thought of those disdainful and arrogant lords and the soulless haughtiness of government. What did they care what happened to people like these? Yes, such governments might go through gestures of justice and perhaps even social work, but they remained cold, hard forces that could disrupt and shatter lives and people without conscience, without a second thought. Chief Chong Wan was getting them organized. He told Johnny, as he rushed by, that he was moving them all to the old mine site dome that had been cleaned up. It had rooms underground, and the armor cable was working there now. Well, Johnny was free of the signing conference. Dunaldine was available to take over. In ops, he asked Dunaldine,
"Any news from Edinburgh come in with this tribe?"
Dunaldine shook his head. Johnny grabbed an air mask and flight jacket.
"Then I'm off to find Stormalong."
He got no further than the exit to the bowl. Ah! He collided head-on with Stormalong himself.
"Where have you been?"
cried Johnny.
"I have called and called and called."
Stormalong pushed him into a bunker where they could not be overheard.
"I've been fighting and flying my goggles off for days."
He looked it. He was gaunt and hollow of eye. His white scarf was dirty, his jacket stained with sweat and grease. He even had a gun burn in his shoulder.
"You're hurt,"
said Johnny.
No, it's nothing. A Draken officer wouldn't surrender. I had to chase him with a marine attack plane. Imagine it, him on foot running up the side of a mountain, Ben Lomond, and me having to stun him, not kill him, just stun him, mind you, with a blast cannon. And then when I landed and got out, he was just plain dead and he shot me, and I had to stun him again with a handgun. Oh, laddie, it has been a wild time."
"What have you been doing?"
demanded Johnny, making no sense of it.
"Catching prisoners. They left marines and pilots scattered around the Singapore site. Some wounded, some not. They didn't bother to pick up their wounded in Russia. Dunaldine must have shot down 30 enemy planes around Edinburgh, and pilots that ejected are scattered to the west and in the Highlands. It takes some doing, let me tell you, to pick them up. They think they'll be tortured or sprinkled with virus or killed. And they don't surrender easily."
"All by yourself?"
"Except for half a dozen bank guards. And they're French, Johnny. They're not soldiers. They can maybe guard a vault or carry valuables."
"Stormalong, I had radios in all those places. You must have had your set on. People must have seen you."
None of it made any sense to Johnny.